I didn't even realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a back seat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Hey, Michael Steele podcast listeners, Michael Steele here with another quick take from the Michael Steele podcast. Check out what's going on right now.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Michael Steele podcast. I'm Michael Steele and having a great conversation, a lot of fun with my brother here, Mehdi Hassan, a colleague and friend at MSNBC. But right now, we're focusing on his best-selling book, Win Every Argument, The Art of Debating, Persuading, and Public Speaking. Yeah, you never wing it. And you talk about this in the book, and I think this would be a good jump-off point in this conversation. The difference between a conversation and a debate. Because when you're on TV doing your thing on the Mehdi Hassan show, I'm on TV doing my thing as a talking head. You're at once engaged in a conversation.
Yeah.
But then you also, you know, depending on who you're talking with, could sort of slide into a little bit of a debate.
Yeah.
How do you see that? And talk to me about some of the differences between those two styles.
Not just those two styles, multiple styles, Michael. I mean, what I say in the book and what I say in every interview that I do about the book is context matters. Everything comes back to context. People say, well, hold on, you know, the arguments that you use to convince your crazy uncle at the Thanksgiving table are not the same arguments you use to win over a crowd in a university auditorium or to win over a TV audience in primetime on cable. Yes.
Right.
Exactly my point. You've got to be flexible. You've got to adapt. You know, Yasser Arafat, the former Palestinian leader, a lot of Israelis used to slam him with this line, Michael, that he speaks in two tongues. He says in Arabic something, and then he says something different in English. Now, whether that's true or not, an argument for another day. But the point being is, like I say in the book, there's nothing wrong with speaking to different audiences in different ways. It's not dishonest. I'm not telling you to be right wing in front of one crowd, left wing in front of another. I'm saying be able to tailor your message to who's in front of you and what you're trying to achieve. Are you trying to rhetorically defeat an opponent who you dislike or disagree with, or are trying to beat in a formal competition? That requires a different style. To are you trying to convince your uncle at the Thanksgiving table who's saying crazy stuff about microchips and vaccines, but you love crazy Uncle Tom. You don't want to attack him personally. You want to win him over. So it's a different style. It's a different approach. And you can use different rhetorical strategies in different ways, depending on where you are. So in the book, I try and lay out, here's what you do if you're in a formal debate. You're in a high school debate. You're being graded by a judge. But here's what you do if you're with a friend who you want to really get through to, or if you're with an audience of strangers. You know, I've stood in front of audiences where, this audience, they don't like me. They don't come from where I come from. They have a different set of politics. But I still have to try and get through to them. What do I do? So you really have to adapt your message, your tone, your style, your content based on who's in front of you. And the reason I start the book, there's 16 chapters. Chapter one is know your audience. That is key. If you don't understand who you're targeting your appeal, who you're appealing to, who you're trying to persuade, who you're trying to convince, then you've lost before, you know, you've got out the starting gate.
Yeah, that last point is so damned important. it is amazing to me the number of times that people, particularly politicians, get in front of an audience and don't know who they're speaking to. Yeah. I recall when I was a young county chairman, I had a candidate that was running for Congress in the 4th Congressional District here in Prince George's County, Maryland. And I went to one of his little town hall that he did. And he got up, nice little conservative chap. He stood up in front of this office audience, again, Prince George's County, Maryland. At that time, the largest, wealthiest Black county in the United States. And he goes up and he starts laying out the fundamentals of what he wanted to do when he got to Congress. He wanted to, lower taxes. He wanted to, invigorate entrepreneurs. And as he said to the audience, I'm going to go there and reduce the size of government, smaller government, da, 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 da. He went through the whole thing. So after his little town hall, I got up and I went up to him. I said, that was really good. But I just have one question. Who were you talking to? Mm-hmm. And he looked at me and he goes, I was talking to the women in the, women and men in the audience. I said, well, but who was your audience? And so I had to help him. I said, your audience was primarily comprised of middle-class African-American federal government employees. So when you said to them, send me to Congress so I can reduce the size of government,
yes.
What do you think they heard?
Yeah.
And he paused. I said, you just told all of them you want to fire them.
Yeah.
And so it really does matter an understanding fundamentally of your audience. And this is one thing that I will give Trump credit for. He knows his audience. He knows how to speak to that audience. He knows how to move that audience with his rhetoric. His presentation sucks. His reading skills are atrocious. His ability to just fundamentally communicate are suspect. But he knows his audience, and somehow he's able to get all of it to work.
I'm gonna half agree with you. He definitely knows his audience at his rallies. He knows how to GOP. He knows how to win over GOP base. But you'll remember, Michael, if you remember the first presidential debate in 2020, you remember that car crash where he's shouting and talking over Biden and Chris Wallace.
Yes.
That's his audience that night was not the base. His audience that night was independent, swing voters, people he needs to win over who are very skeptical of Trump. And he plays. The problem with Trump is once he's won over his audience, he doesn't want to broaden the appeal. The fundamental problem with the GOP right now, as even Nikki Haley pointed out in her opening speech for running for president, haven't won the popular vote for 7 of the last 8 presidential elections. You need to be able to expand the electorate. And Trump is not the guy who's interested in expanding electorate. You know, he talks about my people, the worst thing you can talk about when you're running for national office nationwide. Like I talk about in the book about how there was a time when I was on a BBC panel in England, in a small rural town in southern England. It's an all-white, elderly Daily Mail reading crowd. I'm on a panel, and I'm one of only two people in the entire room who's under the age of 40 at the time. And they asked me a question about deporting an alleged terrorist to the Middle East, and the crowd all want to do it. I'm like, how do I, what do I say to this crowd? If I quote Human Rights Watch or Amnesty, they don't care.
If I quote
the European Convention on Human Rights, they don't care. What do I do? How do I connect with this crowd? So what do? I have to identify with that crowd. I'm a brown lefty on the panel. They're a white, small C conservative crowd. What do I say? I say, let's talk Magna Carta. Let's talk the British Constitution of 1215.
Yes.
What do we as a country stand for? We stand for habeas corpus. We stand for no detention without trial. We stand against torture. And the crowd applauded me, even though moments earlier they'd been completely against me. Why? Because I knew there's no point. I can't make them more hostile than they already are.
Right.
I have to find common ground. Yeah, we disagree on everything else, but we're all proud Britons who believe in the history of liberty.
So that actually speaks to how you open the book. You start talking about feelings, not just facts. And reading through that, you kind of get this sense that a lot of times people, it's almost like a competition between feelings and facts.
Yes.
And people just feel they have to, I got to overwhelm them with the facts. And you see this a lot with a lot of my friends on the left in sort of dealing with MAGA or Republicans, even back in the day when Republicans were normal. they kind of would lead a little bit more in to the heavy part with, you know, the feelings and, you know, oh, poor this, we got to deal with that. And Republicans on the reverse would like, you know, but here's the bottom line. This is how much GDP is growing. This is what happens if you raise the minimum wage. And that people seem to get lost in translating the difference between feelings and facts and understanding. And that, what you just noted there, is a good example of understanding A, your audience, and B,
how to connect emotion.
Less about the facts, because you will likely be right on the facts.
Yeah, you got to be right on the facts, but facts alone are not enough. Right. And if you think you're going to persuade people just here, you've lost. You have to persuade them in your heart, not just your head. And if it's heart versus head, the heart wins. And again, to come back to our friend, Mr. Trump, he gets this, right? He knows how to rile up his base emotionally. Right. He is a demagogue. He does it in the worst possible way. He riles up the worst possible emotions, our darkest side, our fear, our loathing, our victimhood, our grievances, our paranoia, our hatred of the foreigner and the other. But he does it very well. And up against a message in 2016, for example, that was build a wall, lock her up, ban Muslims. Very, very emotive, demagogic messages. Hillary Clinton comes along and says, here's my 16-point childcare plan.
Right.
That just is not going to work. Like, I'm sure Hillary Clinton's childcare plan was amazing and would have helped parents in this country. But that is not what's going to get people to the voting booth. And Democrats for far too long have not understood this very obvious point. People do not vote based on policy. That we are not kind of super rational, cold-blooded calculators who step into the voting booth and say, well, the Democratic candidate is going to raise GDP by 6.2%,
right.
The Republican candidate by 6.1%, therefore I will vote Democrat. No, they go in and they say, oh, George Bush is the kind of guy I want to have a barbecue with, Al Gore, not so much. Donald Trump's the kind of guy who wants to tear down the corruption in D.C. Hillary Clinton, she's very cold and, you know, just talks in wonky numbers. Like, unfortunately, you know, I wish the world wasn't that way, but we have to live in the world as it is, not as the world as we want it to be. We are not filled with people just deploying the Socratic method. We're filled with warm-blooded, emotional, you know, Dale Carnegie, I quote him in the book, you know, human beings are not creatures of logic, we are creatures of emotion. Therefore, if we're going to persuade them, we have to have emotive arguments. And another example I gave in the book, you said when Republicans were normal, I mean, George Bush Sr. in 1988 is up against Michael Dukakis. That Bernard Shaw of CNN asks Dukakis, would you still support the death penalty if Kitty Dukakis, your wife, were raped and murdered? The crowd, what a question. And Dukakis gives a long, rambling, boring answer about how he would cut drug crime and what Massachusetts crime levels are. And everyone's wondering, the guy just said your wife was raped and killed. Where is some emotion, man? Like, you should be mad. They wanted to see their commander-in-chief's gut reaction, and he didn't show any emotion. And his campaign manager that night said, the moment he said that, I knew we'd lost.
Well, I was just pulling up some of the sort of tools of the trade you're talking about in the book. You know, for example, you know, when we talk about know your audience and all of that, but tell a story, choose your words wisely. The other piece was show, don't just tell.
Which Dukakis didn't.
Right.
He was flat. He was a robot. No sign of emotion on his face or in his body language.
Exactly.
I mean, a lot of what we do to persuade people comes from our eyes, from our face, from our body language. I quote Tony Montana in the book, you know, Scarface.
Yes.
It's the eyes, Chico. They never lie. Like, people are looking, they're not just hearing your voice. They're not just listening to the facts and figures. They are evaluating you as a person, as a messenger, as a communicator. They bond not just with your argument, but with you personally.
So you have in the book, this chapter, you ask the question at the top, how did the wholly unqualified Donald J. Trump, a former reality TV star and failed property developer, defeat 16 Republican rivals in the race for the 2016 GOP presidential nomination? How'd he do it?
I mean, there are many answers. In that chapter, you're quoting from the chapter, which is called Play the Man and the Ball, not just the ball.
Right.
And that's a chapter on ad hominem attacks. And I'm referring there to the way in which Donald Trump was able to kind of deflate and undermine his many opponents with kind of crude nicknames, which, you know, all of us openly would say, oh, that's so immature and childish. But deep down, we're thinking, actually, that kind of works. I mean, we don't want to admit it, but, you know, low energy Bush, low energy Jeb. Yeah, Lion Ted, Little Marco, these things stick. I mean, Trump has very few skills in life, but, you know, he's the schoolyard bully who's very good at nicknaming people. Let's see how far Meatball Ron and Ron DeSanctimonious go. Not so great. But my point in that chapter is not to say we should be like Trump and just verbally abuse right. people and give people nicknames, but I'm making a broader point about the fact that, going back to Aristotle, ethos right. is a part of our appeal. It's not just pathos, emotion, which we talked about, or logos, the facts and the figures. Ethos matters too, your personal credibility. People don't just decide on an argument. If two people are making a case for and against, they don't just decide the audience based on some abstract idea of what's right and wrong. They also look at who's making the argument. Do I trust that person? Right. Do I like that person? Are they qualified to speak on this topic? And that's totally fine. That makes sense. So I say in the book, look, don't run away from ad hominem attacks. We're told these, you can't go ad hom. It means you've lost the argument if you go ad hom. No, not necessarily. There are certain types of ad hominem attacks which are relevant. And I define three in the book. I say, for example, the abusive ad hominem, not, you know, oh, you're fat or ugly. No.
Right.
But if somebody lies, for example, if you're on a debate stage with Donald Trump, of course you should tell the audience he's a liar and that right. they shouldn't trust him. He has a history of deceit. Yeah, don't trust this guy. He has a history of lying. That's, of course, it's a dereliction of duty not to do that. Similarly, if you're on a debate stage with somebody who's saying, you know what, climate change, it's all a myth, and he's paid by ExxonMobil, the circumstantial ad hominem, pointing out the conflict of interest, the circumstances, is also very relevant. And the third type of ad hominem I talk about is the tu quoque, the hypocrisy argument, the Republican politician who says, we should ban all abortions, no exceptions, race, rape and incest, but he has an exception for his mistress. Well, if that, I think it's relevant to bring that up. Now, you might say, well, that's an unfair personal attack. It doesn't actually affect, you know, the actual substance of the argument about abortion and viability and fetal pain. I get that. That's true.
It goes to credibility, though.
But it goes to, not just credibility, it goes to the idea of, this person wants you to agree with their principles, principles they can't seem to live by. So maybe right. there's something tricky about those principles. Maybe we need to scrutinize this further. And people say, well, ad hominem attack is a logical fallacy. And in logical terms, it is. But my book's about rhetoric. It's about communication. And in the world of communications, you want your audience to trust you and not your opponent.
So you set that up, but then I love it. And this is what you just, okay, so let me share with you the other side. Beware the counterattack, right?
Oh, yeah.
And you tell the story of your appearance on Question Time, that the Daily Mail would come after me, for it was inevitable. It was the Daily Mail, after all. Sure enough, the very next day, the paper leaked an extract of a letter that I'd written to them 3 years earlier, asking for an opportunity to write in the Mail. Look, Hassan the hypocrite. So what?
It's a risky strategy.
It's a risky strategy.
It's a high reward, high risk strategy. If you get the ad hom right, you can completely put your opponent on the ropes. You can destroy their credibility, but then they come after you. And this has happened to me all the time. It happened to me right now. So this, you know, it goes with the territory. So I wouldn't advise everyone to go down the ad hom road, but if you feel it's relevant, go for it. But then realize that if you're able to attack your opponent's credibility, they have the right to attack yours.
Hey, everybody, thanks so much for listening today. Please go to Apple Podcasts and give us a 5-star review. Heck, give us 2 5-star reviews. I love it. Or catch us on Stitcher, iHeart, TuneIn, or wherever you get that podcast thing on. You know how that goes. Peace out.
Is it just me, or have we all lost our minds? It's a question more and more people are asking themselves, afraid to admit they already know the answer. It's also a podcast, one about people coming together in a time of division and uncertainty to talk about culture and politics, compromise and connections. It's about challenging the norms we've come to accept as a society and working together to find common ground. Fierce and Unfiltered, host Jennifer Horn is a former Republican strategist and party leader turned independent sanity activist. One way or another, we've all lost our minds. Join Jennifer Horn in the search to find them again.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Weight Watchers now offers access to affordable GLP-1s.
Weight Watchers has everything I need.
from weight loss medications to nutrition support and help with my side effects.
With our program, our members are losing more weight with expert nutrition and side effect support.
Weight Watchers prescribing GLP-1 medications, it's been life-changing.
Better results, expert support, lose more weight, make it last. Get started today for as low as $25 at WeightWatchers.com. Weight Watchers now offers access to affordable GLP-1s. It works for members like...
I'm Haley, and I've lost 100 pounds. Weight Watchers has everything I need, from weight loss medications to nutrition support and help with my side effects. It's all in one place.
Weight Watchers handles the insurance for you and offers affordable cash pay options. With our program, our members are losing more weight with expert nutrition and side effect support.
I'm Mike, and I've lost 135 pounds. Weight Watchers prescribing GLP-1 medications, it's been life-changing.
I'm Sharia, and I lost 80 pounds on Weight Watchers.
I realized that it would take more than a prescription to lose weight and feel good on a GLP-1.
Better results, expert support, lose more weight, make it last.
I can't imagine doing a GLP-1 without Weight Watchers.
Get started for as low as $25 at weightwatchers.com/GLP-1. For over 60 years, we've helped millions of members find what works for them. Now, it's your turn. Weight Watchers, watch it work.